to another matter. One of our own, as I say, actually two of our own, got a very fine award recently, and more or less by way of introducing them. You know our Richard Crowley, that used to do Morning Ireland and is now based in Israel? Well, apparently at one point he was attempting to visit the Palestinian refugee camp at Jenin on the anniversary of the massacre, and he found Palestinians suspicious that he might be an Israeli agent till he mentioned the name of Caoimhe Butterley, which opened doors for him.
Despite the assurances of the Palestinian TV crew, who vouched for the fact that I was not an Israeli agent, our contact was still very wary, until I mentioned Caoimhe Butterley. Then it was warm handshakes and urgent phone calls to find one of the fighters of Jenin to interview. The young Irish woman who stayed in the camp during the fiercest of fighting, doing what she could to prevent the death of Palestinian women and children, has established Ireland here as a country which cared when the world stood idly by.
And that was from Richard. Now, Caoimhe Butterley is sitting opposite me, and the reason for this is that she was named as one of Time magazine's 36 European heroes, and I said that we had one of our own, then two of our own, actually with three, because Bono and Christina Noble were included in that as well. Caoimhe, good morning to you, and you're very welcome.
Good morning.
Listen, tell us a little bit about your own background, because it's not a typical Irish background by any stretch of the imagination.
Not really. My parents immigrated to Canada when I was quite young, and then were working in different African countries for a few years.
Why?
They were working on contracts. My mother's a family therapist, so she was working with a family therapy centre. My dad was working with other projects as well.
Of a developmental nature?
Yeah.
Right.
So I grew up primarily in Africa, and then spent some time in New York and Mexico and Guatemala before moving over to the Middle East. So it wasn't your typical upbringing.
No, it certainly wasn't.
But it was a good one in the sense of preparing me, perhaps, you know, for the last 2 years at least.
And where were you in Canada? Toronto?
No, in Nova Scotia.
In Nova Scotia. And you stayed there until what age?
Until I was about 11.
Right. And then where did you go to school after that?
Primarily in Mauritius and Zimbabwe.
In Mauritius and Zimbabwe. So were you reared in an atmosphere of consciousness about the third world?
Yeah. I think the way in which we travelled, you know, my parents tried to give us, you know, the deepest possible sort of analysis or you know, viewing of the situations that we were living in. You know, so our eyes definitely weren't closed to what we were living in. And I think they also, you know, for both myself and my brothers and sisters, tried to empower us, you know, with the knowledge that in very small ways, you know, that we could sort of remain true to our consciences or try and make, you know, very, very small changes, but definitely sort of challenge the status quo.
So are your other brothers and sisters, are they involved in as activists as well?
They're young still, actually.
What ages are they?
17, 15 and 11.
And are they showing signs, as they say?
Oh, they are. the youngest particularly. But again, you know, I think whatever, you know, sort of passes is true to them, they'll follow. And, you know, I certainly wouldn't try and control them into my particular line of thinking. Oh. But again, you know, I think that they have a very deep, you know, sort of sense of awareness of what's really going on in different parts of the world.
And when you were being educated in Zimbabwe, when was that?
From the age of about 13 to 18 or so.
Which was when?
Gosh.
Was it the 80s? Was it the 90s?
The 90s, yeah.
And was that when the... because I'm trying to place it in politically, so to speak, in development in Zimbabwe.
It was when the Movement for Democratic Change, which was formerly an organisation called ZimRights, was sort of evolving, you know, into the very strong force for opposition, you know, that it is now. So it was the beginning, I think, of a, you know, very legitimate challenge to the more repressive policies of Robert Mugabe's government. It has gotten a lot worse in terms of the level of repression that particularly the MDC is meeting, you know, most markedly in the last few days. So it was very much a time, you know, where there was a little bit of hope, I think, that there could be effective change.
And when you went to school, did you go to a mixed school?
Yeah, yeah.
Right. So on the racist question, Has that, because I've heard people visiting here who, say, are white farmers giving a version of things, and I've heard people, spokespersons from London, say that might represent the government line, and they would say, well, the white people were very ungenerous. And where we're hearing that there's a nutcase running the show and that, you know, he's turning what was a breadbasket of Africa into a place where there's going to be famine. Does the truth lie somewhere in the middle?
I think in any reference, you know, to the very repressive policies of Robert Mugabe's government, one has to contextualize them, you know, into also a very bloody colonial history where a system of virtual apartheid was practiced in Zimbabwe. You know, the two cannot be separated. But what was, you know, a revolutionary government that definitely, you know, made a lot of, I think, self-sacrifice in the interests of the liberation of Zimbabwe has evolved, you know, into a very corrupt, very brutal regime. That sort of evolution or process has been seen, you know, the full sort of cycle in many parts of the world. And Zimbabwe at this stage is no stranger. Zimbabweans are no stranger, you know, to having suffered not only under colonialism, but now under, you know, a government of similar.
Right. Is your family still there?
No, they live in France.
They live in France. Right. So when you finished your education, did you go to third level?
No. I moved over to New York, intending actually just to take a gap year and then to continue with my studies. I ended up working at a place called the Catholic Worker, which is a soup kitchen and a house of hospitality for homeless men. And there, I think, you know, sort of things that I'd felt, not really on an abstract level in the sense that I'd done different forms of voluntary work from a pretty young age, but definitely, you know, political sort of inclinations that I found that the Catholic Worker was a good place to sort of really fine hone and focus on and find a way in which I could channel, you know, what I was feeling into something.
Did you go looking for them, or did you trip across them?
My parents were working in the Simon community while I was growing up, and in similar types of houses of hospitality in Canada with refugees and homeless people. So I'd sort of grown up, you know, hearing the name. And I did sort of trip over them. But again, you know, I think the peace and social justice community, particularly in the States, is a pretty small one, you know, so people know each other.
It is a small one?
It's a growing one. But in terms of, you know, things like long-term accompaniment and Latin American solidarity movements and the sort of stuff that I was involved in there, and eventually Voices in the Wilderness, which I now work with in Iraq, yes, you know, it's a fairly small one.
Yeah, who are Voices in the Wilderness?
They're a US-based group. They're based in Chicago. It was founded by a number of people, among them Kathy Kelly, who was just here doing a speaking tour. They're set up primarily to campaign around, you know, the immorality and the genocidal nature of the 12 years of sanctions that had been imposed upon Iraq. To campaign around them to try and, you know, heighten the level of education, to desanitize the language around them, and also to symbolically break them.
Right.
So for that 12-year period, regular delegations, particularly of American citizens, went to Iraq with medical supplies, both to learn and to symbolically break
right.
the
sanctions. And when did you join them?
I sort of first met them about 6 years ago when I was in New York, and did a 3-week sort of hunger strike with them outside the United Nations, particularly around the sanctions, just calling, you know, the UN to be a voice of conscience and courage in condemning the nature of them and to end them. At that point, you know, obviously, I think 3 weeks sort of fasting with a group of people, you tend to get to know them in and out. And I did feel, you know, that of many different sort of movements or groups that I'd met, that they were very, I mean, first of all, I think it was the fact that they were faith-based, but that there was a great humility to them and very much a view that this was a very long-term struggle, you know, but that they were in it for the long haul.
Right. So if that was 6 years ago, how did the Middle East enter your life?
I lived in Latin America for a few years, working in refugee camps as a human rights observer, basically, and then with women's education projects, and also in Chiapas. I came back to Cork, I came to Ireland and ended up working in Cork for a few months. Working in the English market, teaching English, whatever I could get my hands on, to be quite honest. But I was in Cork when September the 11th happened. And I just remember being very horrified at the fact, you know, that a great tragedy and a great loss of, you know, innocent human life was being really used as a smokescreen by the American administration in stirring up just a lot of racism. It came across as such.
Did you not have any sympathy for the Americans in that?
Oh, of course I did. You know, I know people who were personally affected by September 11th. I had incredible sympathy. But the thing that really deeply disturbed me was that, and I found that since the sort of dishonor of the lives of the people who died on September the 11th, that the loss of their lives is being used as a pretext to kill other people, you know.
Just look at that, though, for a moment. If you take the concept of self-defense, if somebody comes in here wielding a hatchet, I mean, I don't actually have anything, but one does defend oneself. They were attacked in their own homeland, and they were shocked and terrified by it. What would you say they should have done?
I think, just to finish that line, I mean, my own motivations in terms of hearing the rhetoric that was coming out in the media to travel to the Middle East was to try and get a better sense of, you know, the question that is asked oftentimes in American media, you know, why us? Why do they hate us so much? To try and get a sense, you know, of what the Middle East was. And I think when I traveled there, you know, I got a sense of a very resilient, very loving, very capable race of people who are being thoroughly misrepresented in the media.
Who?
Mostly people of the Middle East, you know.
All of the people of the Middle East?
No, I mean, I think that there are human beings everywhere, you know, that there are good and bad and in between in any context. I'm not trying to sort of glorify or, you know, a particular race of people. But I think that one thing that has impressed me greatly, particularly in Iraq and Palestine, is the fact that people really differentiate between the policies of a government and between the people, you know, of the countries, you know, such as the United States.
Yes, except that if you take the bombings in Bali and you take the bombing, the Twin Towers, they were ordinary people. They weren't the people, the policymakers. They were people getting on with their lives.
Of course not. And in that sense, you know, I think that it's, again...
And what would you do? Supposing you were... Because I don't know what I would do. I mean, I'm not asking this to... So if you were President Bush and the Twin Towers happened on your watch, you're supposed to be minding the American people, what would you do?
I don't think that the response, I don't know what I would do, to be quite honest. I don't think the response to September the 11th has honored the lives of people lost there. The very tenuous links drawn between September 11th and Iraq, as opposed to the much more blatant links, you know, such as Saudi Arabia and much more brutal sort of repressive regimes. If they're talking about terrorism, I think that there are two types of terrorism. There are individual acts of terrorism and there's state-sponsored terrorism. And in some ways, you know, the very sanitized language of war tends, you know, to lead people to forget, you know, that a person, you know, with a sort of suicide bomb strapped around their waist, or somebody who hijacks a plane and kills an enormous amount of innocent people in the process. It's a different type of terrorism, but it's really the same, I think, as cluster bombs being dropped on captive civilian populations or genocidal sanctions in which, you know, a civilian infrastructure which keeps a people alive is deliberately targeted, such as the water and sanitation plants and electricity grid stations in Iraq, which in itself constitutes, you know, a war crime.
Can I just get it clear in my head? After September the 11th, you went to Palestine?
I went to Iraq. Initially.
You went to Iraq?
Yes.
Not Afghanistan?
No, I couldn't get a visa to go to Pakistan, actually. That was intention. But again, because...
To do what?
I think that's partially the reason that I went to Iraq, because I felt that there was a much stronger structure there, that there was a precedent of people going there on solidarity visits, and there was a structure in which we could actually do effective...
But solidarity with what? Because there was no suggestion at that point that... I mean, the sanctions are a whole other story, but solidarity after September the 11th, solidarity with what? It wasn't a fundamentalist state.
No, but Iraq had most definitely been in the sights of the United States for quite a few years. And if, you know, one can trace back to sort of rhetoric that was, you know, when they were talking about the axis of evil, etc., Iraq was mentioned frequently when talking about Afghanistan. And people did believe that that would be the next step immediately afterwards, December, you know, following the bombing campaigns in Afghanistan. I mean, I think in some ways, you know,
September the 11th happened. Mm-hmm. Very short, well, not immediately, but pretty shortly after that. The bombing started in Afghanistan. When did you go to Iraq?
I went to Iraq in early December. And just to finish on that sentence, you know, I think in some ways, just to explain perhaps to the listener, that I don't think it's accessible for most people, sort of thinking of people deliberately going into war zones. And in some ways, I think that I have been portrayed as a little bit of a headbanger in the media. And part of that is probably, you know, my own not sort of being careful enough of my own boundaries and saying that I'm not afraid to die, etc., which I think can be misinterpreted and was probably a comparatively stupid thing to say to
you. Because I read somewhere that you set yourself up to be shot in Jenin.
No, I mean, that's most definitely not true. But just to explain in the context, I think that when you're talking about places like Iraq and Palestine, they are countries that have been collectively abandoned by the international community. I don't think it's particularly pleasant or desirable, you know, to go into situations where you bond with people, you know, where you make friends and integrate yourself into a community and have to see people, you know, killed, the victims of casual killings or more targeted assassinations. But in the vacuum of effective sort of political change or courage, in terms of questioning, you know, the foreign policies of many countries which have disastrous effects, you know, in places like Iraq and Palestine, that it is necessary to have, you know, an international solidarity or independent witnessing, you know, to have people there trying to speak, you know.
So we have September the 11th. December you head to Iraq to show solidarity. What do you mean by that? Just to go and live there? Did you work there?
I did. We were working with primarily an education program with children, just linking them up, the kids in the United States and Britain, to try and sort of demystify, you know, a lot of the myths and the racism that was being pumped out in the media, you know, to put a human face to...
On the word Iraq.
On the word Iraq, on the people of Iraq, you know, the fact that they had been...
So you were there in December?
I was there in December.
Right. And how long did you stay there?
A month and a half.
A month and a half.
Until the visa ran out.
And then
went to Palestine, intending to stay 3 months and then go back to Iraq. But again, you know, sort of witnessing the nature of the slow drip genocide and system of apartheid that Palestinians are suffering at the moment. It's very difficult to engage and then to leave it, because there is this feeling of other people just being completely collectively abandoned, you know, whether it's through fairly innocuous things compared to, you know, the more larger massacres such as curfews. You know, there is a daily death toll, you know, a daily toll of people being wounded, of their lives being desecrated, you know, being subjugated and brutalized and collectively terrorized, you know, really state-sponsored terrorism. And witnessing that, you know, it's very hard.
And I have to say, to come back to you, because there would be an enormous sympathy here for the Palestinians, perhaps more so than there is nowadays for the Israelis. And yet Israel exists for there to be a place where Jewish people can feel safe. And it is probably the place where Jewish people feel least safe at the moment.
Yeah.
So I have to put the question to you again, that if you are minding your people in the Jewish in the Jewish state, and there are people coming in who will kill themselves and will kill your citizens, what would you do?
I don't think there can be any viable peace or situation.
What would you do, though?
Any justice when you have a very brutal, and it is a very, very brutal, illegal according to over 68 UN resolutions, military occupation. What I would do personally is end that military occupation. I think that can be the only viable solution.
And if you're talking
about the liberation of fear,
yes,
that they hold the key to the liberation in their own pocket, the Israeli administration, if they want to end the bombing,
so
the end
if
the occupation,
they did, if
the bombings
did.
Will end. Without a doubt, the bombings will end. It is not a political strategy that has worked. It hasn't garnered no sympathy, and it has targeted innocent civilian lives. Mm. It has been counterproductive.
Mm.
But it is stemming
into
the incredible desperation of people who are collectively abandoned and living in smaller and smaller concentration camps.
Yeah. If you look at what was on offer to Barak, now obviously there are people of all shades who will disagree with whether he was right or whether he was wrong, or I'm talking about Yasser Arafat. Do you think he has served his people well by declaring that second intifada?
I don't think Yasser Arafat is responsible for the second intifada. I think that is a common myth perpetuated by a very sophisticated spin machine. It is a grassroots movement. It is not dictated by a single person, because that almost denies the legitimacy of millions of people.
So if you say that if the occupation, and many would say the illegal occupation of the West Bank and Gaza ended, that That would be a political decision made by Yasser Arafat or in conjunction with negotiation with Yasser Arafat. But has he any control over them? Or is he sympathetic to, because they always talk about Yasser Arafat's Hamas group?
No, they talk about his Fatah group, but Yasser Arafat,
yes.
Yasser Arafat is not a representative voice of his people, as the Palestinian Authority is not a representative voice of their people, because they are handpicked and hand-selected, by the Israeli administration. He was elected. Abu Mazen, who is the chief negotiator at the moment in this roadmap to the Tantal disaster, was selected. You know, he is a puppet whose strings can be pulled. That is seen very clearly.
By Yasser Arafat?
By the Israeli and American administrations. It's just very unfortunate to see, you know, the fact that I think the precedent of Oslo, which has materially made life considerably worse for the majority of Palestinians, which has furthered a system of apartheid, which has enabled the breaking up of the occupied West Bank and Gaza Strip into virtual bantustans, that, you know, the international community is holding its breath again over another sort of settlement, you know, which I don't think viably, you know, can be any path to peace.
What do you see as your role? You're not going back to Palestine now, you're going to Iraq.
I just came from Iraq a few days ago and I'll be going back on Sunday. I came back, you know, partially because I had the ticket paid for me by Time magazine, and I used that sort of ceremony as basically as a platform in which, you know, to sort of accept him on behalf of a friend of mine who bled to death, and to contextualize, you know, the work, and also to call on people to sort of observe amidst silence for Palestinian victims of Israeli apartheid and state-sponsored terrorism, words that are a little bit hard to get past the sound barrier sometimes.
Because they sound, now I know you don't mean it, Patrick, but they sound like jargon and gobbledygook.
Of course I do. Partially, I think, because they have been abused in many ways. I don't think it's an abuse to use them in this particular context. It is not an exaggeration. But I came back primarily now to try and, I'm doing a variety of public talks, among them one tonight in Galway, but just to try and give people a sense of the reality on the ground in Iraq at the moment, you know, sort of post-invasion, and to give the people, you know, a sense, you know, that in terms of solidarity, in terms of a viable anti-war movement, that we have to sort of go past some mantras, and that a little bit of introspection and sophistication has to go on, but that really, you know, the links have to be built with Iraqi civil society and different initiatives, Iraqi NGOs, etc., that are now attempting to work in a really disastrous situation, you know, on the brink of a humanitarian disaster and a situation which...
Are you glad to see Saddam gone?
Of course. I think, you know, every person with any sense in their head is glad to see him gone. But however, what has been left in its wake...
Is a
situation, you know, people are living in limbo in a state of perpetual terror. I think Iraqis have been shown that their blood has been cheapened, terror of the future, that the sanctity of their lives has not been respected by the American administration, you know, through 12 years of genocidal sanctions, with Madeleine Albright saying that the price of 500,000 Iraqi children dead was worth it. I don't think that they have any particular faith that, you know, the sanctity of their life will be respected now.
Clearly, people will say that you are kind of off the Richter scale anti-American.
Not at all. I think some of the most courageous, most beautiful people that I've met in my life in terms of the peace and social justice movement are American.
Okay. Quiva Bhatti. Well, listen, congratulations on your award. Does it mean a lot to you?
No.
Okay. Quiva Bhatti, good morning to you.